Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Tonight, a story of passion and politics from To Everything a Season by Kingston writer Stephen Hyten. These linked stories explore the endings of relationships in a family over three generations. Hyten captures the last fleeting moments of love with delicacy and grace. We've already met Alden, a retired geography professor, more comfortable with reflection than action. Safe in his study, he now imagines the life of his more lively ancestor. Summer Fires is read by Robert Boxtall.
In the early summer of 1839, Alden's great-great-grandfather, Caleb MacLeod, found his way back to Brockville, his wife Charlotte, and their three small children. He arrived long after midnight. He was filthy and sunburnt. His stern, bulging blue eyes had sunk back in his skull, and the fierce, determined jut of the chin, so striking in his portrait, was hidden under a matted bush of beard. His prematurely thin red hair had thinned still further, and his fiery brows had thickened in the 7 months since his capture and 5 weeks since his escape. Alden pictured him standing in the doorway before his wife, a storybook giant grown thin. So changed now, face flickering in the weak glow of the candle Charlotte has brought to the door. The story of Caleb's famous insurgency, flight, and exile had been heirloomed along through the generations as far as Alden, then his children, Annie and Caleb, the known facts hammered down during its passage to the gritty essentials. Likewise, Caleb's story had grown in spirit as it shriveled in fact, so by the time it was entrusted to Alden, his ancestor loomed as a mythic romantic giant who both inspired and intimidated his heirs. Alden could trace his fascination with the rugged and fickle geography of the region to the story of Caleb's escape from Fort Henry in mid-May 1839, a few days before he was to be shipped out for Quebec, Portsmouth, and Van Diemen's Land, and his 5-week wilderness journey north to the edge of the Shield Country, then furtively east and south again to Brockville. Alden felt certain, too, that the unruly wanderlust of his son Caleb's youth, Banff, Vancouver, Australia, had sprung also from Caleb Sr., from his example as much as his genes. Alden, after all, had never much liked to travel, or even leave his solid house, let alone his study. But who could tell? After all, young Caleb's footloose enthusiasms had cooled, and he now lived a steady, productive life as a prison literacy and music teacher, married in Winnipeg. So perhaps Caleb Sr., a blacksmith by trade, had loved the warm confines of his shop. Alden pictured him on a winter's day, flushed with the crackling heat of the forge, his great red eyebrows singed and curling, the firelight mirrored above his temples on the bald scalp. He savors the warm, private manual work, the mundane spectacle of golden sparks cascading from the hammered anvil, its rhythmic clanging as intimate as his own pulse. Alden loved too much the stillness and setness of his maps and study ever to throw himself wholly into the fray. But his great-great-grandfather had done that, thrown himself in. Surely, though, the injustices of his age had been harsher, more sharply defined. Sometimes Alden was not so sure. But Caleb, a mild giant of a man who loved the confines of his workshop and the hearth-like heat of the forge, who loved his hearth, his wife Charlotte, and three small children, Caleb, had made up his mind and beat his dead father's plowshare into a sword. The story first joins him in the fall of 1837 when he is 36 years old and established as one of the four blacksmiths in the town of Brockville. He is a hard-working, pious man who reads to his wife and children from the Bible each night before supper. His blood, steeped in the sober egalitarianism of his Scots forebears, has warmed at the despotic pranks and machinations of the ruling family compact, steamed at their summer decrees, and comes to a rolling boil in the fall of 37 after a run of incendiary sermons by local politicos and the visiting radical William Lyon Mackenzie. In November, Caleb closes shop and canters toward York, or Toronto, with 12 other Brockville men. A few of them are armed with muskets. Caleb carries a kind of lance he has improvised by lashing a long, home-beaten blade onto a staff. In York, family tradition casts our hero willy-nilly in a starring role on a decidedly ill-starred stage. During the rebels' pell-mell flight from Montgomery's tavern, the gallant blacksmith holds off a body of militiamen with his shining lance and thus helps scores of comrades evade capture, even death. Here, the family storysmiths beat a hurried retreat, and Caleb is seen back in his workshop with markedly less work to lay on the anvil because customers have switched to other shops during his 3-week absence, and the Tories among them, hearing rumors of his treason, have sworn never to come back. Nothing is told here of Charlotte, but surely her feelings can be guessed. For 3 weeks, no income, and now an income greatly reduced. 3 weeks alone, with the children, at night, wondering if her husband has been shot, imprisoned, hanged. Unrest smolders again through the hot summer of 38, and the autumn winds, like a bellows by the forge at dawn, fan it to high flame. More fighting in Lower Canada. 100 soldiers and patriots dead in the snow near Beauharnois. So the rumor runs. In November, a force of Canadian patriots and sympathetic Yankees is ferried across the St. Lawrence below Brockville, hoping to seize Fort Wellington. Caleb and his comrades, undaunted by last autumn's debacle, are there to join them. The whole force falls back on an old windmill above the river and is soon besieged by British soldiers and local militia. 4 days inside the yard-thick limestone walls, while fire rages and fades in the buildings around the mill, then bursts through the oak floor of the mill inside. Flame-red jackets moving over the brown grasses of the field, like a brush fire, closing in. Caleb is captured, trussed, and carted with over 100 others to Fort Henry in Kingston, where a young lawyer named Sir John A. MacDonald defends their leader, but to no avail. The leader is to be hanged along with 10 others, and along with 59 others, Caleb is sentenced to transportation to Van Diemen's Land in May. In March, when the worst of the winter is past, Charlotte and the children accomplish the rough 2-day journey from Brockville to Kingston to say farewell. The children weep and shiver in the damp gray corridors of Fort Henry, Dickensian waifs clinging to the full skirts of their pallid, frightened mother. A rushed visit, kisses for the children who hardly recognize their father, his face, his clothing, his smell. A few moments in private for Caleb and Charlotte, Charlotte torn by fear and regret and anger and desire and who knows what else. Anger, but there is so little time. And so much anger. Your smithy is lost and your children halfway orphaned and but the guards have come. An iron door clangs shut. In mid-May, a few days before he is to be shipped out for Quebec, Portsmouth, and Australia, Caleb escapes a work detail outside the fort walls. With the hammer that he wields to crush rock, his expert hands, so the story goes, neatly smash the shackles, and he is spotted, too late, in full stride over the newly green fields, his prison trousers flapping round bloodied ankles as he lopes downhill for the river. It has been a warm spring, and had it been otherwise, Caleb could hardly have survived his first night. Shivering, wet in the soft, needled shelter of a small pine, after running north along the Cataractway and braving its unusually mild waters at a ford. In the morning he cuts inland and thrashes north through the wilderness above Kingston. Near Westport, it is said, he finds in a deserted shack some old moth-ravaged woolens and a bit of dried food. He stays for several days to recoup his strength, then moves on. North. Through the forest, a stone's throw east of the Perth Road, so that he hears and sometimes catches a glimpse of traffic on the road. A troop of red-coated cavalry cantering south, on the lookout for someone. Or farmers and settlers bound north from Kingston on one-horse carts, laden with topsoil and seed potatoes and sacks of grain. Caleb, a beanstalk of a giant not born for stealth, sidling through the undergrowth and darting barefoot for silence onto the king's road behind a clattering cart, grabbing whatever he can, a few seed potatoes, a turnip, sometimes only seed. Stronger now and more acquainted with stealth, he escapes even the mythmakers who lose him in dense forest and only catch him in passing glances through the woods or darting at nightfall with his giant strides over the new seeded fields north of Brockville. He surprises them and Charlotte sometime after midnight on Midsummer's Eve, 1839, when he appears, a bearded, sunburned ghost in the doorway of his home. The mythmakers usher him to the table, where his devoted Charlotte serves him his first substantial meal in weeks, and they grant him a brief last look at his sleeping children before he and his wife retire for the night, and he sleeps in a good bed for the first time in months and the last time in his life. With a modesty and discretion suited to the authors of stories that may be told to children, the mythmakers do not shadow the reunited pair over the threshold of their room, or even grant us a keyhole peep. But in his later years, especially after he and Holly had moved to separate rooms, Alden often wondered what his forebears' last night had been like. Had they made love again? Caleb must have been mortally tired, Charlotte desperately afraid, and angry. But by all accounts, Caleb was a fiery, impetuous giant of a man, and Alden felt sure, in his study under that smoldering charcoal gaze, that he would have squeezed his wife in a last mighty bear hug. It is a sultry, windless night, so that even with the window above the bed propped open, the flame of the candle on the bedside table does not stir. Caleb peels off his matted clothing and washes quickly at the basin, sighing richly, but with a now instinctive softness as the water streams over his body and face. Charlotte sits on the side of the bed in her summer nightgown, bare feet on the floor. She stares into the flame of the candle, then looks down at her lap, the patient hands folded together a little too tightly. Caleb in his old nightshirt on the bed beside her, mumbled words. Where will he go in the morning? Away. Again? He must go away again. No, no. But she admits that, yes, men have come to the house many times, men with firearms and pointed questions. Her hands clench tighter, the knuckles blanched and angry. Then she turns on Caleb with a sudden embrace. He responds with his usual clumsy ardor, and the candle flame wavers in the breeze of their coupling. So thin he is under his shirt, yet still heavy. She kisses his balding scalp, the massive brow and eyes and beard. Stay, she says, for the sake of your children, hide here until they forget. And he clenches her tighter, till she can hardly breathe or move or say another word. This man she has cursed every day of his absence and craved, Alden thinks, every night. As usual, it is over too soon. Sadness, deeper than usual, and the old embering coals of shame. Van Diemen's Land. They are sweating with the heat, as if the single candle is a hearth, a forge. They have never before made love in the light. Charlotte blows out the candle, and Caleb, within seconds, is snoring heavily. She turns from him, the ache inside her unfulfilled, anger flaring up to fill it. For with morning he will leave and start fading from his family's eyes to something as dim as the light this glowing wick still casts. A character in a story read once as a child, his name forgotten with the story's name. Nothing left but an aura, a tone of voice, a few flickering details. The story has it that he did not leave, he was taken. At first light, a platoon of red-coated soldiers hammered on the door, and Caleb was seized by four strong men as he leapt in his nightshirt from the bedroom window. And here the forgers of the story follow him for the last time, as he is marched in irons down the cobbled streets of Brockville to the river, and up the gangplank of a sloop bound for Quebec, then Portsmouth, then Australia. They lose him as the ship leans out and ferries him away with the current and a clean summer wind. Who can add further chapters? His own son, thought Alden, the son he named Caleb, who has seen Botany Bay and Tasmania. The story ends that Charlotte conceived her third child that night, Alden's great-grandmother, Sarah. Sarah, in her cradle by the hearth, in late March, cooing. Her cries a dim, high echo of her father's deep bass. Reading from scripture, at table, in a much brighter season. After the fire, a still, small voice.
That was Robert Boxtall reading from To Everything a Season from the collection On Earth as It Is. Tomorrow night, we return to a present-day love in The Fall Wind, the last of Stephen Hyten's quartet of tales about relationships. Our poetry nightcap is about ancestors and the cultural importance of memory. What We Lost was written by the Irish poet Evan Boland. It's about her grandmother's way of life, and an aspect of the past that's virtually been forgotten. It's read by Kelly Fox.
What We Lost. It is a winter afternoon. The hills are frozen, light is failing. The distance is a crystal earshot. A woman is mending linen in her kitchen. She is a country woman. Behind her cupboard door, she hangs sprigged, stove-dried lavender in muslin. Her letters and mementos and memories are packeted in satin at the back, with gabardine and worsted, and the cambric she has made into bodices, the good tobacco silk for Sunday mass. She is sewing in the kitchen. The sugar feel of flax is in her hands. Dusk. And the candles brought in then, one by one, and the quiet sweat of wax. There is a child at her side. The tea is poured, the stitching put down. The child grows still, sensing something of importance. The woman settles and begins her story. Believe it. What we lost is here in this room on this veiled evening. The woman finishes. The story ends. The child, who is my mother, gets up, moves away. In the winter air, unheard, unshared, the moment happens, hangs fire, leads nowhere. The light will fail and the room darken, the child fall asleep and the story be forgotten. The fields are dark already. The frail connections have been made and are broken. The dumb show of legend has become language, is becoming silence. And who will know that once words were possibilities and disappointments, were scented closets filled with love letters and memories and lavender hemmed into muslin, stored in sachets, aired in bed linen, and traveled silks and the tones of cotton tautened into bodices, subtly shaped by breathing, were the rooms of childhood with their griefless peace, their hands and whispers, their candles weeping brightly.
Kelly Fox, reading Evan Boland's poem, What We Lost. It's from Boland's collection, An Origin Like Water, published by W.W. Norton. And that's our program for this evening. If you'd like to write to us, we can be reached at Between the Covers, Post Office Box 4600, Vancouver, B.C., V6B4A2. Our email address is btc@vancouver.cbc.ca. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.